This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
President Zelensky of Ukraine says NATO's refusal to agree to a no-fly zone is equal to green-lighting Russia's bombing campaign. Russia accuses Ukrainian saboteurs of setting ablaze a nuclear power plant in southeast Ukraine. Kyiv calls that a lie and warns the attack could have catastrophic consequences. Also, head IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi is in Tehran for technical discussions, just as negotiators from Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal work to hammer out an agreement in Vienna. Thank you for joining us. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky slams NATO for ruling out a no-fly zone over his country.
For 9 days we have been seeing a fierce war. They are destroying our cities, shelling our people, our children, residential neighborhoods, churches and schools. They are destroying everything that ensures a normal life, human life, and they want to continue it. Knowing that new strikes and casualties are inevitable, NATO deliberately decided not to close the sky over Ukraine.
Zelensky said NATO's rejection of an air exclusion zone comes as it knows more Russian attacks are likely. It said this gives a green light to Russia to bomb more Ukrainian cities and villages. The Ukrainian president also described NATO's Friday summit on the issue as weak and confused. The Western military alliance rejected Kyiv's calls for a no-fly zone over Ukraine amid Russia's military campaign in the country. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg warned that any such step would lead to a full-fledged war in Europe involving many more countries and causing much more human suffering. Moscow denies allegations that its forces shelled Europe's largest nuclear power plant in southeastern Ukraine. It follows a fire that erupted at the facility Thursday after what Kyiv called a Russian attack.
Today we have once again heard lies about how Russian troops attacked the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. And this is all part of an unprecedented campaign of lies and disinformation against Russia. You're trying to present the situation in such a way as though the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant was allegedly shelled by the Russian military, as a result of which a fire broke out.
The Russian ambassador made the remarks during an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council. He said the meeting is another attempt by officials in Kyiv to stir what he called artificial hysteria about the developments in Ukraine. He accused Ukrainian saboteurs of setting fire to the nuclear plant following a battle with Russian troops near the facility in Zaporizhzhia. The Ukrainian ambassador, however, accused Moscow of lying. He said attacking the power plant could lead to a huge catastrophe.
If at any point the cooling process is disturbed, this could cause radioactive damage across large territories and have irreparable consequences for the environment of the entire continent. Thousands of people, including civilians, who are currently unable to evacuate the area near the plant due to ongoing shelling and fighting, would be affected.
The envoy urged the international community to stop the Russian military campaign as a common duty. He also called for the expulsion of Russia from international institutions. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. also accused Russia of having attacked the nuclear site. The ambassador said it was incredibly reckless and reflected a, quote, dangerous new escalation in Russia's assault on Ukraine. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell claims unprecedented sanctions being imposed by the West on Russia are not designed to oust Vladimir Putin. A series of emergency meetings have been taking place in Brussels to discuss Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
EU foreign affairs ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says the sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledge the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops to eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainian, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
Unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency has arrived in Tehran. His visit comes amid the Vienna talks to revive the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA. Rafael Grossi is scheduled to hold talks with Iranian officials, including head of Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. Iran and P4+1 are yet to reach an agreement in the Vienna talks. On Friday, Iran's top diplomat told the EU foreign policy chief that Tehran is ready to immediately finalize a good agreement on the JCPOA. He, however, stressed that the West's haste cannot prevent Tehran from observing its red lines. Amir Abdullahian noted the announcement of a possible deal rests upon fulfillment of Iran's demands, including guarantees for its effective implementation. Earlier, we spoke to our correspondent Homa Lezgi in Vienna. She says Iran has insisted that the revival of the JCPOA hinges on resolving the outstanding issues that have been discussed during the negotiations in the Austrian capital.
When we are talking about the prospect for these talks, how long it's still going to take, if there is even a possibility of a collapse or not. Russian Ambassador Mikhail Oryanov last night was saying that he doesn't think it's going to collapse at this stage. They are so close to the finish line now. However, this doesn't mean, both Iranians have said this, the Americans have said this, that there is an agreement. Some issues still remain. We're hearing that one of them is, of course, the issue of claims regarding Iran's nuclear activities. But there is also, we're hearing, the issue of economic guarantees that Iran is seeking. Today we had various meetings, including one between the Iranian team with the presence of the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Affairs, Mr. Safari, alongside the head of the Iranian delegation, Mr. Barghari, with the E3 representatives, which were supposedly focused on that issue among other outstanding remaining issues. So we'll have to see some sources, even the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Oryanov, said that a final decision with the presence of the foreign ministers could happen on Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. I think the decision is one to be made by the negotiators themselves, based upon where they're standing.
Israel and the United Arab Emirates boost their ties further with Abu Dhabi, allowing Tel Aviv to resume a full schedule of flights to the Sheikhdom. Israel's internal spy agency Shin Bet says the two sides have settled a dispute over airport security that forced them to cut back air services. Israel's flag carrier Al Al has welcomed the announcement, saying it will immediately return to operating up to four flights a day. Non-stop flights from Tel Aviv to Dubai were among the issues agreed upon as part of a U.S.-backed normalization deal between Israel and the UAE. That deal was clinched in 2020, drawing strong backlash from Muslims and Palestinians, to see the accord as a betrayal of their cause. South Korea says the North has fired a suspected missile toward the sea to the east of the Korean Peninsula. The launch is the ninth by North Korea this year. Pyongyang also carried out a record number of missile tests in January, including its most powerful projectile since 2017. North Korea's launches have drawn criticism by the United States and its allies for, in their words, destabilizing the Korean Peninsula. But Pyongyang says its tests are defensive. It says they are a response to U.S. hostilities and provocation, including its regular war games with South Korea. In order to discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Andrew Lung, an independent China specialist joining us from Hong Kong. Andrew, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us. Well, let's just discuss the timing of this latest test, because it comes just days before the South Korea presidential election. Can this have anything to do with the upcoming presidential election? And if yes, how can it affect the election? Can it sway voters from one party to another?
Well, I don't think it's got any bearing on the election, because this is nothing new. The North Koreans have always always lost the kind of confidence in the so-called talks with the United States and with South Korea. I mean, for example, the so-called six-party talks have been going on a long, long time and would come to nothing. And then what the United States-led talks meant for North Korea was that the North Korea needed to give up everything, giving up its capability to defend itself before even the talks began. Well, that's absolutely a no-go area for North Korea. So the North Koreans are learning from the playbook of Chairman Mao in the early days, developing its own nuclear capabilities and also its missile capabilities so as to shore up its own defenses. And then if it should come to the talks, this would give the North Koreans much more robust bargaining chips. And the timing of this is nothing to do, I don't think, is less to do with what's happening in South Korea than to what's happening in Ukraine, because the whole world is now focusing on Ukraine, especially the United States and North Korea's main adversaries. So it's a good time for North Korea to continue to conduct these tests to shore up its own defense capabilities.
Many thanks for joining us. That was Andrew Leung, an independent China specialist, joining us from Hong Kong. Reactions are pouring in following a deadly suicide bombing that devastated a Shia mosque in the northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar on Friday. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the bombing. He said places of worship should be safe havens, not targets of attacks. Iraq's top Shia cleric Ayatollah Ali Sistani denounced the tragic incident too. He called on Islamabad to tackle terrorist groups and not allow them to commit crimes against innocent people, especially religious minorities. Iran said the attack was aimed at sowing discord among Muslims. And the European Union slammed the bombing as a heinous crime. The blast targeted worshippers during Friday prayers, killing 56 and injuring dozens. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility. It's 1 year since a Met police officer murdered 31-year-old Sarah Everard in the UK. In response to the tragedy, which has undermined the public's trust in the force, the government says it is spending millions on making women safer. Bianca Rahimi tells us more from London.
Over the past 12 months, 125 women have been killed by men in the UK, the youngest being 16. Most were attacked by someone they knew, like current or former partners, and died in their own homes. But it was on the street in March 2021 that Sarah Everard was kidnapped. Every week, 2 to 3 women are killed here in the UK. But Sarah's case sent shockwaves across the country because the man that kidnapped, raped and murdered her was a serving Met police officer. Wayne Cousins. The force knew he was dangerous. His nickname was the rapist among his colleagues. A day before the murder, there were complaints made against him for indecent exposure. And now some of his former colleagues are under investigation for engaging in sexually and racially charged banter with Cousins over WhatsApp. He is now serving a life sentence. The Met said it was ashamed and disgusted that one of its own was responsible for Sarah's death. But the toxic culture within the force was common knowledge.
They employ people who look like them, and they are invariably white males. And this overwhelming number of white males who are employed in the Met become indoctrinated into the working culture, which has been in existence for 30 or 40 years, which pays no regard to what the law or what the policies may say. You can have the law and policy you like, but if you don't change the culture, which gives men an almost entitlement to abuse and violate women, then all the laws in the world are not going to change the experience of women.
Caught on the hop, Number 10 tried to appease the public after Sarah's murder, pledging to spend millions of pounds on better lighting, CCTV, and sending plainclothes officers into pubs and clubs. But do women feel safer? After all, Sarah was snatched by a police officer.
Yeah, definitely more cautious. I think walking around this area, I feel a bit of an eeriness. Always texting my mates where I'm going.
And I guess along with everything else that we're finding, you know, hearing about the police at the moment, yeah, you do think, well, can I trust a policeman?
The public don't have confidence in the police and the government anymore. And I feel like that this government right now is out of touch when it comes to these type of crimes and these type of issues. And that especially, you know, men, we should play our part, you know, in that just making sure that all these rules are passed and that, you know, women, they should just be able to feel safe in the community generally.
Police officers in half of the UK's forces are now being investigated for using their powers for sexual gain. Since Sarah's murder, a string of controversies have further undermined public confidence in the Met, and its former commissioner, Cressida Dick, has resigned. Meanwhile, women on the UK's streets remain hyper-vigilant. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a narrow and unanimous decision, the Supreme Court justices ruled that a 1978 law governing national security surveillance did not displace the state secrets doctrine. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Liptak. The piece is titled Supreme Court Sides with FBI in Case on Spying on Muslims. The U.S. Supreme Court on Friday, 4th of March 2022, unanimously rejected an argument that could have limited the sweep of the state secrets doctrine in a case arising from the surveillance of Muslims in Southern California, United States in 2006. The decision by the U.S. Supreme Court came a day after the justices weighed in on another case involving the state secrets doctrine, which sometimes requires the dismissal of lawsuits that would disclose information that could harm national security. In a fractured decision on Thursday, 3rd of March, the Supreme Court ruled that the doctrine barred Abu Zubaydah, who was waterboarded more than 60 times and tortured at Guantanamo Bay and is being held without charge at Guantanamo Bay, from obtaining testimony from two CIA contractors who were instrumental in his brutal interrogations. Friday's ruling was more modest than technical. It concerned surveillance undertaken by Craig Montale, an FBI informant that failed to produce any public evidence of wrongdoing. To the contrary, after Mr. Montale started talking about violence at a mosque in Irvine, California, a community leader contacted the FBI to report him. Three of the American Muslim men Mr. Montale spied on sued the FBI and the agents responsible for directing him, claiming, among other things, that their right to exercise their religion had been violated in the United States. The government moved to dismiss those claims, invoking the state's secrets privilege and saying that disclosure of the information it needed to mount a defense to the lawsuit would threaten America's national security. Meanwhile, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in 2019. The appeals court said that a provision of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, of 1978 established procedures for considering national security information and that the trial judge should have used them instead of dismissing the case after the government invoked the state secrets doctrine. Congress intended FISA, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, to displace the state secrets privilege, Judge Marsha Berzin wrote for a unanimous three-judge panel of the appeals court. Justice Samuel Alito, writing for the U.S. Supreme Court, said that was an improper reading of FISA. There was no indication, he wrote, that Congress had meant to affect the privilege. FISA, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, makes no reference to the state secrets privilege, he wrote. It neither mentions the privilege by name nor uses any identifiable synonym, and its only reference to the subject of privilege reflects a desire to avoid the alteration of privilege law. The statute, moreover, serves a different purpose than the privilege, he wrote. Under FISA, he wrote, the central question is the lawfulness of surveillance. But, Justice Samuel Alito added, we have never suggested that an assertion of the state secrets privilege can be defeated by showing that the evidence was unlawfully obtained. Supreme Court Justice Alito wrote that several important questions remain to be decided by the appeals court in the case FBI versus Fazaga, number 20828. Including the fundamental one of whether the state secrets privilege applies. Brian Frazel, a lawyer with the Constitutional Accountability Center, which filed a brief supporting the Muslim men subjected to the surveillance, said the ruling could have been worse. While we are disappointed that the Supreme Court did not recognize that FISA displaces the state secrets privilege, he said in a statement, we're relieved that the court stopped there, leaving other questions open in a way that may allow for accountability in this and in other cases.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The crisis in Syria. The successes of the Syrian army and its allies at the end of 2014 gave the Syrian people hope in finding a solution to the crisis. But the hope did not last long, because in the early months of 2015, the situation changed in favor of the opposition. In March 2015, Jaish al-Fatah announced its formation. Jaish al-Fatah was formed when a number of extremist Salafi groups like the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham united. As a first step, Jaish al-Fatah attacked the city of Idlib and was able to take full control of it in a short time. Idlib is the provincial capital of the province of Idlib in northwestern Syria. It borders Turkey, and its proximity to the coastal provinces gives it a strategic position. Jaish al-Fatah continued its advances in Idlib province, and after a short time, it conquered the city of Cisrashuhur. With the fall of Cisrashuhur, the cities of Fo'a and Kafaria faced a critical situation. Fo'a and Kafaria are two Shia-dominated cities in Idlib province, which were completely besieged by Jaish al-Fatah. The residents of Fo'a and Kafaria knew that if the cities fell, Nusra Front forces would massacre everyone. That's why they resisted tooth and nail. When there was no way of delivering aid to these cities, Iranian military transport planes took over the responsibility of sending aid to the cities so that the people could resist for a longer time. The rapid withdrawal of the Syrian army from Idlib province showed that the Syrian army was incapable of confronting the forces of Jaish al-Fatah. Because Idlib shares a border with Turkey, Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham were well backed by Turkey, and this made taking back these regions difficult. At this stage, the advances of Jaish al-Fatah toward Aleppo or the coastal provinces had to be stopped. For this reason, on the order of General Soleimani, a new phase of organizing forces under Iranian command began. Initially, the involvement of the Iranian Air Force in Syria was raised, but General Soleimani did not consider it suitable. So the Iranians decided to persuade Russia to send its air force to Syria. The Russians had a strong interest in maintaining the government of Bashar Assad because Syria had long been Russia's strategic base in the Middle East. Aside from that, the large number of Chechen forces among Salafi armed groups in Syria had made confronting them one of Russia's national security priorities.
If you go to Moscow, and I do, and you go and see the Kremlin, you look over the Kremlin wall, due south, you see Chechnya, which Putin is still very worried about as a seat of Islamic revolution, you see. And Putin, if you keep on looking beyond Chechnya, you see the minarets of Damascus.
General Qasem Soleimani recently visited Moscow to meet with senior Russian leaders.
At the time, some news agencies reported that General Soleimani had met with Putin, a meeting which was aimed at convincing Putin of military intervention in Syria. Participation of the Russian Air Force, the Iranians also increased the size of their forces in Syria. The new forces that had come from Iran were no longer just advisors, but were organized in the form of combat forces. The IRGC now commanded a front consisting of multinational ground forces and was supported by the Russian Air Force. This powerful combination could change the balance of power on the battlefield in favor of the Syrian government, and it was natural that it would lead to the opposition of countries that supported the armed opposition. Turkey was angrier than any other country at the presence of the Russian Air Force. Its President Erdogan knew that the presence of Iranian forces and Russian air support could make things difficult for the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham. But this was not the only problem Turkey had. On October the 10th, 2015, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces announced their formation in the city of Hasaka. The main structure of these forces was the Kurdish defenders of the city of Kobani. They had previously been supported by the Syrian army and the IRGC in the fight against Daesh, but now they had gotten closer to the Americans. Because these forces were openly supported by the U.S. and the Syrian government did not want to directly engage the U.S., it avoided taking a clear stance against them. The priority of the Syrian army at this time was to eliminate the Takfiri groups. But the formation of these forces angered Turkey. A large part of the Syrian Democratic Forces was made up of fighters from the PKK, which Turkey had designated as a terrorist group. Now, the Americans were strengthening them along the borders of Turkey, and this was not acceptable to the Turkish government. All of this had exacerbated Erdogan's stance against the US and Russia. On November the 24th, 2015, a Russian Air Force Sukhoi 24 aircraft was shot down by a Turkish plane in the north of Syria. Turkey's prime minister announced that the aircraft had ignored warnings and entered Turkish soil for 17 seconds. The two pilots of the aircraft ejected. One of them was found by Russian patrols, but the other one was killed by Nusra Front forces. Vladimir Putin explicitly stated that the incident would not go unanswered and demanded an official apology from the Turks. On the other side, Erdogan not only did not apologize, but also warned that it would be better for Russia not to play with fire. Erdogan was almost certain that in the event of a Russian response, NATO forces would intervene in support of the Turkish army. But instead of a military response, Putin imposed a series of economic sanctions on Turkey. He banned the import of fruits and vegetables from Turkey and stopped the export of gas to the country. On the other hand, he also banned Russian citizens from traveling to Turkey. The sanctions were a severe blow to Turkey's economy, as the country hosted about 4 million Russian tourists a year and imported half of its gas from Russia. All of these pressures prompted Erdogan to formally apologize to Russia, contrary to his pledges, and to announce that he was ready to pay damages for the plane crash and compensate the killing of its pilot. At the same time, the UN Secretary General's envoy called on the influential countries involved in the crisis in Syria to gather in Vienna to find a political solution to the conflict. Although such meetings had been fruitless in the past, the Vienna conference had undergone several changes which may have made a difference. The first feature was the presence of Iran. Until then, because of Iran's insistence on the continued rule of Bashar Assad, the Americans had prevented Iran from being invited to such meetings. But now, after the JCPOA had been signed, the U.S. sought to persuade Iran to change its regional positions. For that reason, it did not object to Iran's invitation to the conference. even though Syrian opposition groups stated that they will boycott the summit if Iran attended, the UN had not invited any of them to the meeting to begin with. The second feature of the conference was that it coincided with Daesh operations in European cities. A few days before the summit, Paris witnessed a series of unprecedented terrorist operations which Daesh claimed responsibility for. This meant that European countries had more incentives in finding a political solution and ending the crisis in Syria. Therefore, there were possibilities that they may give up some of their strong positions against Bashar Assad. Although the Vienna conference was held with these assumptions, once again the countries influential in the Syrian crisis could not reach a practical agreement. The most important difference, as in the past, were the fate of the legitimate government of Syria and how to deal with terrorist groups. A few days after the Vienna meeting, the Syrian army announced that it had targeted Zahran Alush on the outskirts of Damascus with the cooperation of the Russian Air Force. Zahran Alush was the leader of Jaish al-Islam, which had control of the Ghouta region in the suburbs of Damascus. He was an influential figure among the armed opposition who was openly supported by Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis were trying to convince the international community that he and his group, Jaish al-Islam, were a moderate opposition force. The proximity of the Ghouta region to Damascus and its geological complexity had always been a serious threat to the security of the capital. Therefore, weakening Jaish al-Islam was one of the main priorities of the Syrian army and its allies. Even though Jaish al-Islam immediately announced its new commander, Saudi Arabia knew that it could not easily find a person with the abilities of Zahran Alush. With the death of Alush, the hundreds of millions of dollars spent to strengthen him were practically lost. But Saudi Arabia was reluctant to accept this fact and instead tried to escalate tensions with Iran even higher. A few days after the death of Zahran Alush, Saudi Arabia executed Shia cleric Sheikh Nimran Nimr, who was a critic of the Saudi government. As it was anticipated, the execution of Sheikh Nimr caused the anger of Shias across the world. A group of Iranians gathered in front of the Saudi embassy in Tehran and the Saudi consulate in Mashhad. Their protest gradually escalated into violence, and Iranian police were unable to prevent protesters from entering the Saudi embassy building. The protesters set fire to parts of the Saudi embassy and destroyed its property. Iran announced that it had arrested the protesters and formally condemned their actions. But Saudi Arabia recalled its diplomats from Iran due to insecurity, and diplomatic relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia were completely severed. Some other Arab countries also withdrew their diplomats from Iran in support of Saudi Arabia. As these events were going on, Haj Qasem Soleimani was busy planning the complete liberation of the city. On the other hand, Turkey would under no conditions allow Aleppo to come under the control of the Syrian government. Under these circumstances, the IRGC's Quds force carried out the first phase of the operation to liberate Aleppo in the southwest of the city. During this operation, which was named Nasr, Iranian-led forces were able to retake the strategic city of Khan Tuman from the Jaish al-Fatah and approach the main Aleppo-Hama road. But the beginning of a harsh winter and the arrival of large numbers of troops and weapons from Turkey for Jaish al-Islam forced Iranian-led forces to retreat from Khan Tuman after a while. But Haj Qasem Soleimani immediately implemented the second phase of the operation, this time in eastern Aleppo. In this phase, Iranian-led forces attempted to bypass eastern Aleppo. This operation was carried out on a route that was controlled by Nusra Front on the one end and Daesh on the other. For this reason, everyone thought success would be out of the question. But despite these complexities, Iranian-led forces advanced rapidly and reached Nuble and Az-Zahra in northern Aleppo. With the success of this phase of the operation, Shias living in Nuble and Az-Zahra were liberated from a 3.5-year siege. Now, the city of Aleppo was under siege from the east as well, and this was a great step towards its complete liberation. As the Syrian army and its allies prepared for the great war in Aleppo, armed Salafi groups began to strengthen their positions inside the city. But this strengthening of positions was not limited to military activities. In July 2016, Abu Muhammad Julani sent out a video message announcing that the Nusra Front had been disbanded as an Al-Qaeda-linked group and had been replaced by a new group with no ties to groups outside Syria. The announcement of the severance of ties with Al-Qaeda meant that Fatah al-Sham was supposed to only operate in Syria and did not seek operations around the world like Al-Qaeda. Therefore, it should not be recognized as a terrorist group by the international community. The first reactions to this were made by the Free Army. The Free Army, which identified itself as secular, welcomed the renaming of Nusra, calling them the Sons of the Syrian Nation. Differences emerged within the structure of the Nusra Front. It was reported that some figures close to Al-Qaeda had decided to leave the movement and wanted to launch a new movement that would remain linked to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda reacted to stop the disintegration of Nusra. In an effort to silence protesters, Ahmad Abul Khair, the deputy of Ayman al-Zawahiri, announced in an audio message that the renaming of the Nusra Front had been carried out with the coordination and consent of Al-Qaeda. All these events caused Western countries to turn away from these changes, and Julani's decision to change the name of the Nusra Front was practically useless. The U.S. explicitly stated that the change would not cause the removal of the group from the list of terrorists. As these events unfolded, Lebanon's Hezbollah held a military parade in the city of Qusair to prepare its forces for the Aleppo War. The parade was characterized by the large presence of armored and heavy weapons, something that did not exist before in Hezbollah's combat structure, which was mainly a resistance group. With the parade, Hezbollah showed that the experience of fighting extremist groups in Syria had turned the movement into a full-fledged army. In these circumstances, Haj Qasem Soleimani ordered the beginning of the Aleppo operation. The first phase of the operation was to complete the siege of the eastern part of Aleppo, which was inhabited by armed Salafi groups. At the time, the only connection path of the armed opposition groups was the Castello route in the north of the city. The Castello route connects the eastern region of Aleppo to Idlib province and the Turkish border. The Syrian army announced several safe routes before the operation began so that the residents of eastern Aleppo could leave the area. Some residents used the opportunity and left the militant-held area. They settled in camps set up by the IRGC in the Sheikh Najjar area. At 0 hour of the operation, the Syrian army and its allies launched an offensive to liberate Castello route. The attack was supported by the Russian Air Force. The armed opposition knew that the loss of Castello Rude could bring them closer to losing the entire city of Aleppo. That's why they came to the battlefield with all their might. But despite all their efforts, the Syrian army and forces under Iranian command liberated Castello Rude, and the eastern region of Aleppo was completely besieged. With the completion of the siege of Aleppo, the second phase of the operation began. The purpose of this phase was to liberate the northern neighborhoods and tighten the siege. Before the start of this phase, the people living in the east of Aleppo were once again given the opportunity to leave the city. The Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham, which were planning a major operation aimed at breaking the siege of Aleppo, repeatedly promised the people that the siege of the city would be broken soon. Based on these promises, some of the remaining people in the city, who were ideologically close to the armed groups, refused to leave Aleppo. At the same time, political and media pressures intensified to prevent the complete liberation of Aleppo. Western media outlets regularly reported from inside Aleppo, in which the residents were asking for help.
It's the last of these.
The presence of foreign members of Al-Qaeda on well-known international media outlets had turned into an ordinary event and asking for help from the people.
It's the last time that I talk to you.
People are executed. It's as simple as that.
Turkey and Germany plan to seek...
On the other hand, Turkey and some European countries called for NATO intervention to prevent the liberation of Aleppo.
Speaking after meeting Angela Merkel in Ankara, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet...
Even the UN Security Council sought to pass a resolution for international intervention in Aleppo, which was vetoed by Russia.
In short, it is difficult to deny that Russia is partnering with the Syrian regime to carry out war crimes.
What Russia is sponsoring and doing is not counterterrorism, it is barbarism.
Thanks to this international support, Jaish al-Fatah moved from Idlib province to the southwest of Aleppo with all its might. Their goal was to break the siege of the eastern part. In a fierce battle, Jaish al-Fatah succeeded in breaking the siege of the eastern part of the city by occupying the Ramuse district and the military academy. Now they had to maintain the area so that the process of sending equipment to the forces present in eastern Aleppo could continue. On the other side of the battle, the Syrian army and its allies had to liberate the Ramuse district any way they could. Because without besieging the eastern part, there was no way to completely liberate the city. But this was very difficult because the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham had stationed large numbers of troops and equipment in the area. General Soleimani put Iranian forces in charge of liberating these areas, and heavy battles between the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham began in Ramuse. This fierce battle lasted for 40 days, but eventually extremist Salafi groups retreated with very high casualties, and once again the siege of the eastern part was completed. With the completion of the siege of the city, the process of liberating the eastern part began neighborhood by neighborhood. At this point, the residents of the city were once again given the opportunity to leave. These residents were mostly family members of armed opposition groups. What's happening? They themselves were now sure that they could not resist any longer. That's why they sent families to Idlib on buses provided by the Syrian government. After the families left, the process of liberating the city accelerated and the neighborhoods were liberated one after another. Things got to the point where several thousand gunmen stationed in the city gathered in one neighborhood. They then sought the help of Turkey to create a situation for their safe exit from the city. Erdogan agreed with Putin that the militants hand over their heavy weapons to be allowed to leave Aleppo and go to Idlib. But the agreement between Turkey and Russia was unacceptable to Iran. At the time, thousands of Shias living in Foa and Kafaria were besieged by Jaish al-Fatah for a long time. And if the armed forces were allowed to leave, in return, a part of the residents of Foa and Kafaria had to be released from the siege. In Iran's opinion, Russia's action was a gift to the armed opposition without getting anything back in return. The day after the Turkish-Russian agreement was announced, the first group of militants, who were 1,250 in number, left Aleppo. But General Soleimani ordered the remaining militants to be prevented from leaving, and the Russian-Turkish agreement was effectively annulled. Under General Soleimani's leadership, the Iranians directly contacted Ahrar al-Sham officials who were following the issue of the withdrawal of the militants in order to facilitate the exchange of the residents of Foa and Kafaria with the militants of Aleppo. This was the first direct contact between Iranian forces and extremist Salafi groups. In the end, it was agreed that in exchange for the militants in Aleppo, 3,000 Shia residents of Foa and Kafaria were liberated from the siege. With the exit of all militants from Aleppo, the city was totally liberated from occupation after 5 years. Analysts deemed the complete liberation of Aleppo as a sign of the beginning to resolve the crisis in Syria.
The Limelight.
In Britain, COVID infection levels are rising in Scotland, figures suggest, as it was confirmed that the UK scientific advisers no longer expect to meet regularly to discuss COVID. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's science correspondents Nicola Davis and Hannah Devlin. The piece is titled Scotland's COVID Cases Rise, while England and Northern Ireland show falls. In Britain, COVID infection levels are rising in Scotland, figures suggest, as it was confirmed that the UK scientific advisers no longer expect to meet regularly to discuss COVID. About 1 in 19 people in Scotland had COVID in the week ending 26th of February, according to figures from the Office for National Statistics, based on swabs from randomly selected households. By contrast, infection levels have continued to fall in England and in Northern Ireland, with the trend unclear in Wales. About 1 in 30 people in England are estimated to have had COVID in the week ending 26th of February. With infection levels still high across the United Kingdom, it was confirmed that the government's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, known as SAGE, is not expecting to meet on COVID regularly, though it will stand ready if required. Friday, 4th of March's Office for National Statistics data reveals that the BA2 Omicron variant a close cousin of the original BA1 variant of Omicron, but described as stealth, as it is harder to track, is on the rise in all of United Kingdom countries except Northern Ireland. The BA1 variant of Omicron is in decline in all countries except Scotland. Infection levels in Scotland peaked mostly recently in early January, when about 1 in 18 people had COVID, with levels falling to 1 in 30 by the middle of the month. Since then, they have been rising steadily. The increase appears to be in those around the ages of 30 and 60, with the trend uncertain for children and younger adults. An increase has also been seen in data for confirmed COVID patients in hospital in Scotland. After reaching a peak of 1,571 on 19th of January, the figure fell, hitting 868 on 13th of February. Since then, it has risen to 1,272 COVID patients in hospital in Scotland on 3rd of March. The uptick has not been reflected in hospital admissions data. However, one expert suggested that may be linked to a data problem. Professor Christina Pagel, Director of University College London's Clinical Operational Research Unit and a member of the independent SAGE group, said it was